has won it. They stream out of the dugout. Yeah. Rollins ball near third. This game is over.
Second deck walk-off home run. Grand slam, Bryce Harper.
That's what I call hitting season.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode 534. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Coming up, not a whole lot of real hot-breaking news to get to here in the baseball world outside of what's going on with the labor situation. And we've talked a lot about that over these last couple of weeks, and nothing new to report to you here at this very moment. But we got some other good stuff coming down the line, including a potential big sea change in how we watch Major League Baseball. For those of you looking to cut the cord from your cable subscription or from your either satellite service, there might be something big on the horizon. So we'll talk about that coming up here in just a few minutes. We'll talk about the downfall of the Phillies farm system and kind of look and see where we've come over the last 5 years from what we were like in 2017 to now. And breakout Phillies. Which Phillies could potentially be breakout candidates here in 2022 whenever the season gets underway? So joining me to talk about all that good stuff is my good buddy Justin Clue from Baseball Prospectus and The Dirty Inning and Continued Success and Absolutely Hammered. You can follow him on Twitter at Justin_Clue. Justin, what's up, pal?
So with Liz not here tonight, I think finally we can have a more genuine podcast where we can finally discuss how the owners are. We can talk about how heroic and pure they are.
We've been waiting for Liz to go away for a week so we could finally take up some water for the owners.
Can take the mask off and talk about how big a fan I am of just about every owner in baseball, except for Steve Cohen. He spends a little too freely for my taste.
Surprise fans, but you didn't see this coming.
We're just big fans. I got a John Middleton jersey instead of the eyes over the eyes on the Phillies. It's just his little face. Yeah. And his face have instead of eyeballs, he has little stars. It's my most treasured Phillies possession. It's just nice. It's nice to be able to relax and talk about how great and pure and genuine Major League Baseball owners are.
And really owners across all four sports.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what the lesson we've learned this week in professional sports is ownership, generally speaking, is really knocking it out of the park.
For me, the real sport is what happens behind closed doors in meetings and stuff. You know,
well, that's where the real wins take place.
Yeah, emails, answering phones. That's what I'm passionate about. And so, I hope the meetings go on forever. And frankly, I hope the owners come out on top. Like, what do we lose by billionaires getting a little more? Frankly,
Listen. They're going to have their meetings this week. I forget exactly where they're taking place. They're meeting from Tuesday to Thursday, but I really hope this ragtag group of underdogs can figure out a way to make this work for them.
Yeah. When they make the movie out of this, I hope that Rob Manfred is played by John Cusack and John Milton's played by Billy Bob Thornton. I hope this next meeting is the moment where the dramatic music swells and we realize that the evil players have finally been defeated in their quest to have several rights.
Yeah. Well, listen, you can't have it all. You know,
they need to understand that. Yeah, I wish they would understand that. Yeah.
Because I mean, you've got all the skills. You know, you've been blessed with being able to play baseball. You know, I mean that's pay in and of itself. First of all, so you've got the skills to do it. You don't need as much compensation. You know, just because you have this unbelievably rare skill that 0.001% of the population possesses, that's payment in and of itself. You know, the real hard part is owning a franchise, and people just don't understand that.
It's really hard to inherit a cigar empire. There's a lot of paperwork. You don't know where you're supposed to park your yacht at the secret human hunting island that billionaires only have access to. It's embarrassing. Like, where do I go? There is no, it's not on a map. I don't know where to park my yacht.
Oh, I swear. I don't think, and hear me out on this, in all seriousness, I don't think we would be as hard on ownership if we felt there was some desire on the part of Major League owners to actually meet the players halfway, or for there to actually want to be an agreement to actually better the game. And I think that's where all these labor talks have really kind of depressed me is that yes, each side wants to quote unquote win here. They want what they want, for lack of a better way to put it. But there should be, you know, when you own a Major League Baseball team, there should be something inside you that wants to improve the game. Like you should want for this game that you are a part of. You are a part of a select group of people that gets to own a professional baseball team to want to see that game grow and get better and be fair for everybody. And I think just when you look at these negotiations, you lock out the players for 5 or 6 weeks. You say to spur on negotiations, to move the ball down the field, to get the players to the bargaining table, and then you don't talk for 5 or 6 weeks. You don't initiate any conversation for 5 or 6 weeks, and then you come and you're meeting for an hour and a half during three separate days over a 2 week stretch, and you don't make any meaningful concessions at all. And it's, and then you go to maybe you can, I mentioned this on the Up and In. I know you guys talked a little bit about the stuff, about the labor stuff on Continued Success too, but my sense of this, Justin, is that I don't think the owners are on the same page. I don't know if there is a rift between small market clubs and large market clubs and middle market clubs being kind of split between the two sides, but I genuinely feel like owners did not make a counter offer to the players because I don't think they know what they're going to do. Honestly, I don't think they're on the same page. I think that's what they want a federal mediator in there for, is to, I think they want help to get themselves together, because I don't think they know what to do next. I don't think they know where to go. And the other part of this is that they know they can wait the players out. I guess the question I kind of want to have an answer to here is, how do the players, if the players are going to meaningfully change things, what needs to happen for that to happen? Like, the players don't have any leverage, as far as I can tell.
That's what I keep coming back to, is that the owners, you know, they are, not to sound like Morpheus, but they are locking all the doors and they are holding all the keys. And they cleaned up in the last collective bargaining agreement negotiations, and now we're here, and it's like, oh, the players brought in this tough as nails, very experienced negotiator to you know, lead their efforts, and it was really encouraging to see Max Scherzer and a bunch of other players just take to Twitter after the federal mediator news broke that the owners were going to seek help from a federal mediator, and a bunch of players, you know, pretty much echoed the same sentiment, like it's weird that you need help negotiating. Like, the first step to negotiating is to actually negotiate. So, like, our impression that the owners are just kind of doing nothing and aren't really sure what to do next was almost vindicated by the fact that the players are like, yeah, that's what's happening. Like, we're trying to do something here. And the owners, I mean, you say maybe they're not on the same page together. Maybe there's not even a page.
Yeah.
Like, maybe if they didn't prepare, and I'm not saying they're like, oh, we don't know what, like, they just, their only plan was, well, we can't let them win, so let's do the labor stoppage and figure out the rest later. And, you know, like I think we said in another conversation, calling in for the federal mediator is a classic move. This is and it felt like almost inevitable. We were going to get to that point because owners, you're right. They're just kind of like disoriented and clueless, and all they really know is like, well, we want to come out on top of this like last time, but you know, we're not really sure what to do. It really continues to, it just furthers the notion that like owners are here to take more. They aren't even really sure how it all works, but they are willing to stretch this out as long as they can. You say, you know, you genuinely believe they may not even be on the same page. I say I genuinely believe they never had any intention of baseball starting on time. I don't even think that's going to floor anybody. You know, the boo-hoo letter that Rob Manfred posts on MLB.com when the labor stoppage started, it was ridiculous. You know, like, oh, well, if it's for the fans, the players wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't meet us halfway or whatever, and we want to bring baseball back for the fans. Players owners don't care about the fans. And I mean, it's not like the players can really focus on the fans right now either. I see some people kind of trying to like jump into the mentions and into the argument and like posting these like, well, we're the fans and we have a voice in this too. And like, you have till this day and then we're all going to boycott the sport. It's okay. Yeah. Like relax. Like that's, we are not organized, but I get the sentiment, but like we are even more powerless than the players here.
Right.
And the owners know that, and they can take advantage of that.
And that's the thing. It doesn't hurt the owners as much to lose games and miss part of the season as it does the players. And I just don't know that there's going to – I don't know that there's a
pressure point. The players' jobs are baseball. The owners' jobs are to be rich. They can continue doing that whether or not the players are on the field.
I don't know where the pressure point is, and that's the thing. And that's why I think the union has been the one to kind of make concessions because, and you know, they haven't given up. I mean, they really are pushing for some things, and there seems to be a lot of anger on the player side, rightfully so, that, you know, they want to change the game. They want to fundamentally change certain aspects of the economic structure of the game, and the owners want to keep things the way they are. They don't have an incentive to change things, and until they're forced to, the owners are probably not going to budge, which is what makes this whole situation seem pretty dire, in that nothing's really going to change. We're not going to get a season until somebody caves, because there's not going to be a whole lot of moving towards one another unless there's a drastic change of heart on the part of somebody here. So I know you guys have talked about it on Continued Success. We've all talked about this a lot over these last couple of weeks. That's kind of where things are. And there's some of these I do just want to address, and I think you guys chatted about this too, but one of the narrative that we really need to throw out the window, and I think there was an Associated Press reporter who
– oh, boy.
The write-up that – and I don't remember the name of the reporter, but talking about basically laying blame at the feet of the players for causing basically the season to most likely start late because they refused the help from a federal mediator was just such blatant water carrying for the ownership group. It was irresponsible. I mean,
yeah, his name was Ronald Bloom from AP. And yeah, it almost read like if you weren't viewing it as cynically as probably was appropriate, it almost read like somebody who kind of just joined the news cycle and like hadn't been following the story at all had just written that up. But I think the more accurate way to phrase it is like, oh yeah, this is just something put out by someone who is like, yeah, this is, you know, I'm on the owner's side. Like essentially it was a PR release from right. Major League Baseball.
And here's the other thing too. I know most people listening to this podcast know we mostly come down on the player side on this thing because we see the fundamental issues in the game that need to be fixed. The way the financial structure is set up doesn't make sense. It doesn't work. And that's not because I'm necessarily pro-player or anti-owner or whatever it might happen to be. It just you want a healthy game. You want a healthy game that benefits everybody, where it all works. You want the game of baseball to benefit players when they're at their best, and you know, you get players paid when they're at their best, when they are their most productive. And as they age, you know, you can see pay start to wind down, but there's all kinds of things that have to be put in place in order to encourage teams to spend money, to prevent teams from tanking, to you know, making sure that that you know, you have franchises that aren't going through the motions each and every year. We see it every year that there's franchises going through the motions. And I know the owners are always crying about they want to maintain competitive balance. Well, you know, you've got teams like Pittsburgh and Cincinnati and you know, Oakland and Tampa who have issues, but some of those teams are bad every year. Some of those teams are good every year. They're all small market, but teams find a way. You know, there's the whole point of this is that there are economic issues with the game that even if you don't take a side necessarily, you could see kind of what needs to be done in order for the game to be healthy. But that's not necessarily in the interest of the owners, and that's the problem that we're running into right now.
You know, Rob Maines from Baseball Prospectus gave a great interview on tipping pitches. They reran it the other day, where he talks about why someone becomes a baseball owner, what the appeal is for a very wealthy person to take on the role of ownership. And a lot of times, yes, it's just because you inherited the team from your, you know, relatives. Mm-hmm. It's a family business. But like, you know, back in the day, there was an idea that baseball, you know, you were getting into the business of baseball. Therefore, you had an interest, yes, in business, more so than baseball, but you also had an interest in baseball. Don't get me wrong. These people, having read a lot of stories about old owners, these people were almost, I can't even say transparently sinister in what they did. They were just sinister. Like, there was no even hiding right. It. It was just like, oh, I'm just not going to pay you, the end. But there was just the notion of you're getting into the business of baseball. In the case of owners today, as Rob explains it, there's really two main motivations. And one is you're making an investment in something, but unlike making an investment in, say, Apple stock, you're making an investment in something that cannot bust, essentially. Like, yeah. A baseball team faces bankruptcy, the league bails them out. So you're safe there. And the other thing you're gaining is a minor level of celebrity. You can bring your friends through the locker room. You can sit on local boards and, you can do what John Middleton does. You can come down to the Fandemic crew and wave an air horn in the air and get your picture taken for a photo op. And, you know, there's that, I'm just like this local, there's this local belovedness that you can attempt to garner. But at the end of the day, you know, what does that gain us? You know, like, that's not, I'm not interested in the celebrity of ownership, and I could care less about, you know, what happens to their money as long as it's getting spent on the team, you know, and making the team better. And right. I feel like there's just not any, or at least enough, baseball fans involved in the owning of baseball teams and in the commissioner's office.
Yeah, and I think that's where you naturally see a failing in this setup, is that the Major League Baseball commissioner should be a interested but third party. They should be separated from the owners, but that's the owners hire the commissioner. But the commissioner should be, especially like an inspector general. You know what I mean? They should be the ombudsman. You know, to help spur the two sides along and act as an honest broker in a situation like this. That's really what a league commissioner should be doing. And if we're looking at the breakdown of sports and labor situations, you can't prevent a dog from barking and a cat from meowing. And so when you're talking about owners and players, they're going to act in their own best interest. That's just kind of how human nature is. You definitely need a third party, but it shouldn't come from a federal mediator. You know, it should be the commissioner of the league that's involved in this, in the dispute, to be able to handle this kind of a thing. But that's not the world we live in. And it really never has been the world we live in, but that's kind of how it should be. In order to help these two sides kind of get past themselves and get on, and again, the players are ready to talk. It's the owners that do not have their act together right now. And so I know there's a lot of people listening to this podcast who say millionaires versus billionaires, I don't care, just play ball. We're just trying to illustrate for you guys where the different sides are what's actually happening here, because it's more than that.
You don't have to care, but what we're saying is what's happening. Like, yeah. this is what's going on. So you can keep saying that, but it's a oversimplification of what's going on.
Yeah. Now, we didn't intend to talk for the first 15 minutes about the labor situation, but it's just the first thing that comes up whenever you're talking about baseball right now. We did want to talk about a little piece of news before we get into some Philly stuff here in just a couple of minutes. This came across the wire as I was getting ready for the podcast here on Sunday night, and that is that the Chicago Cubs are in talks with media giant Sinclair Broadcasting. This is from the New York Post. To launch a streaming service for customers without a cable or satellite TV subscription. So essentially a Chicago Cubs streaming service so that fans can watch Cubs games without needing to actually have a cable subscription. Most cable companies will allow you to stream games, but you have to put in your cable subscription username, email address, and password, and you have to have that subscription to watch them stream, at least for in-market games. MLB.TV, which I've had since MLB.TV since, I think, 2006, as someone who was living in Washington, D.C., but wanted to watch Phillies games. I've been an out-of-market watcher of Phillies games, and it's been great for me, but I can't watch Nationals or Orioles games in the market that I'm in right now.
Which are sometimes Phillies games.
Right, exactly. So I miss Phillies games a lot of times, unless I'm over at my father-in-law's house watching his cable TV. And I know my son would love to watch more Nationals games because he's a huge Nationals fan. So, you know, this could be a game changer. And I know this is something that Major League Baseball has kind of been in talks with, even going back to last year. I didn't realize this, but there was an article in the New York Post back last October, which was talking about Major League Baseball in talks to launch a nationwide video streaming service that would allow fans to watch their team's hometown games without a cable TV subscription. It would be a web-based service, which, again, this would eliminate all of the blackout issues that so many fans have in different parts of the country. There are some fans in parts of the country that are blacked out from like six teams, eight teams. They can't watch certain games. They were talking about that something like this could launch as early as 2023. This would also be doing away with regional sports networks, essentially, and Sinclair was said to be a part of this as well. Well, Sinclair has a partial ownership in a number of Major League Baseball teams right now. Commissioner Rob Manfred, however, they're kind of dragging their feet on this, not surprisingly. They're concerned that Sinclair is not a healthy company, and they're a little concerned that they're going to go belly up at some point over the next couple of years. But the reason this is the first time a team has kind of gone out on their own to try and start something. The Cubs have had a hard time getting a deal together with Comcast, who has had the rights to their games for more than a year. So now they're trying to arrange something with Sinclair to have Sinclair stream their games. And this could open things up for all the teams in Major League Baseball to, you know, I don't even know what the Phillies deal is with. It used to be Comcast Sportsnet at the time. What their deal is with the cable company. That was this huge deal when it was signed a few years ago. And now,
oh yeah.
remember that? It's cable, you know, cable's dying, you know, online streaming is the wave of the future. These mm-hmm. kinds of deals, I think it's going to be what, you know, what ends up being the future of baseball broadcasting and broadcasting for other regional sports like the NBA and the NHL. So I know we haven't had a whole lot of time to take a look at this, but just based on first blush, what you're looking at this, Justin, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, like you said, I think it's almost an inevitable future. Also, you know, as you said, the story notes that Rob Manfred is concerned that Sinclair is too waylaid with debt to produce mm-hmm. high-quality broadcasts. My first statement on that is that anything Rob Manfred against, I immediately think, must be a good idea. And secondly, if he's worried about producing high-quality broadcasts, that just means he hasn't watched maybe like half the broadcasts in Major League Baseball currently.
Or any of the games on Facebook.
Oh, my God. The YouTube games, the Facebook games. Yeah. Woof. Yeah. If that's what he's worried about, maybe he needs to talk to the person who was like, what we need is a rectangle next to the game. You can't get rid of it. And it is full of the thoughts of anyone watching the game, and there's also like a steady stream of emojis just like being pumped right in front of the image you're trying to mm-hmm. consume. That's a high quality broadcast. I'm honestly less worried about the quality of a broadcast. Don't get me wrong, I can appreciate a good broadcast, and I think honestly the Phillies have in my lifetime put together a really really quality TV broadcast. So like that has happened in the past.
Yeah.
And you know, it's been great. That's where we've gotten some of the personalities in our Phillies circles and everything. But yeah, this I think is an inevitable future. If it's not with, you know, Sinclair or whatever, then yeah, I think yeah, something like this will occur with a team. One team is going to be the first. And my response is kind of like, yeah, what did you think was going to happen? Like the people, this is an untenable system. I remember I think I've brought it up plenty of times because this has remained an issue. But I wrote a story about youth baseball in Baltimore, and the repeated chorus among all these kids I talked to, these young ball players from like very young to like teenagers, was that, yeah, I love baseball. I don't watch Major League Baseball. If I do, I have to go to my friend's house because like they get the channels that you need to be able to watch my local team.
Yeah.
Because you can't watch your team. I mean, it's a very simple issue. You know, that baseball is like, well, we want to get more people involved. We want to get younger people involved. We want to bring about the next generation of baseball fans. Well, the next generation of baseball fans are out there. They love baseball. They don't love Major League Baseball because they don't have access to your product. And something like this is going to address that directly. Like, we're not going to need, you know, this subscription. We're not going to need to worry about what's blacked out, what region we're in, what regions have been realigned. I mean, there's areas of this country where you can't watch four different Major League Baseball teams' games because of where you happen to have your house. That's not a way to get people to watch your Major League Baseball. So I feel like something like this is inevitable, and I'm not a media analyst, and like you said, I learned about this story in particular 60 seconds before we started recording. I have no doubt there are sinister implications and nefarious plots abound in a case like this, where there's so much money flowing and so many wealthy corporations involved. But the just simple concept that a team would be like, we're going to have this, like, we're going to have our service. You pay us a fee, you get access to the games. That's how it works. It's straightforward enough that I would like stop a couple of the streaming services I currently am using, then, well, not using, but am paying for, right. to be able to yeah, work something like this into the budget, astronomically priced as I'm sure it's going to be.
Well, yeah, they were talking about this this Cubs deal, like $18 a month, which I think would be
That's high. That's very high.
They're saying once the plan is for Sinclair's Bally Sports to begin airing games of teams whose rights it has recently secured. So that includes the Tigers, the Royals, the Marlins, the Brewers, and the Rays, along with the Cubs. So you would probably get all of those teams as part of a package for $18 a month, which, you know, which is fine, but
yeah,
if you're a Cubs fan, you don't really care about watching Brewers games or Royals games. You know, like, if you, I would. I'm a big baseball fan, but
right,
for most Phillies fans, they don't. They're not gonna. You're not gonna really watch a lot of
Rays
games. Yeah,
I think for the most part, you're gonna be talking about people who are interested in watching one team's games.
Right, one team.
But
so how much would you pay for that? Like, for one team? Like, if you're a Phillies fan living in the Philly market, and really all you care about is getting Phillies games, how much per month would you pay for that?
What do we typically pay? You know, you're paying like $8 a month or $12 a month for premium Hulu, like something like that. So yeah, just like in that ballpark, you know,
yeah.
18 is pushing too close to 20, you know, in your head. That rounds up too easily to 20. You put it at 15. I don't know. And I mean, me personally, yeah, I'd be looking at like the $12 a month range just to be able to, like, yeah, just to secure access to that. But like you, I live out of market now, and I have MLB TV, so I don't necessarily even need that. That's not even, like, for me. That's for the people in the Philadelphia area who just want to watch the Phillies without having to pay Comcast, which, again, I fully support that. Comcast taking an L in any form is always, you know, a little rejuvenating. But yeah, I feel like if you get access to all of those teams and you're a fan of one of them, I mean, doesn't it make sense that you get to watch your team, and then, hey, maybe there's a West Coast game and you just like, all right, I'll turn on the 10 o'clock game. And then, or like, you know, your kid starts watching baseball with you, and then suddenly, you know, they don't just want to watch the team that you you follow together. They would just want to watch baseball like you're talking about. I mean, that's how you build fans. That's how you get fans. So that does have some appeal to me.
And I don't think I realized, maybe being out of market for such a long time, but it's kind of passed my, it's totally slipped by my transom that there used to be half of the Phillies games were on free TV every year, like PHL 17.
Yeah, or UPN whatever, at one point.
Yeah,
whatever
it was. And now I don't know that I ever put two and two together that every game is now on pay cable. Like, I used to think when I was a kid and the home games were on Prism, I used to be bummed because we couldn't really afford Prism all that often when we had it for like a year or two here and there. But, you know, I was mostly watching road games because those were on free TV. But that was great because I got to watch, you know, what, 80 games a year or whatever it is I was able to get my hands on free TV. Now, I don't know that I ever really put together that option has totally been eliminated. Well, and I'm trying to remember, when was the last year that the Phillies had like half their games on free TV? Like, when did that transition totally happen?
Because it's definitely still happening. I want to say it, like, you know, what, around the last time they won the World Series. I don't know how long after that, but I feel like it was definitely still happening at that point, where it would be, I forget the name of the other network at that point, that the local network they would put it on. It was it would be like you would go to the cable station and it would be like an infomercial, and you would just immediately know, like, oh, the game's on, you know, the other one today.
UPN or whatever it is. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's I just, for whatever reason, that has not connected with me until just now.
That's a good point. I'd never, why would you notice, you know?
Yeah. Well, because everybody has, you know, at a certain point, everybody had cable. Like, everybody just, they ditched the old, you know, TV receipt with the receivers and, you know, on the UHF channels where you used to get it. And those all went away. Everybody had cable. And so it just made sense. Put the game. Every game's going to be on cable because that's what everybody had. But with cable getting so expensive and sports tiers and sports packages as add-ons and all that stuff, it's gotten away from fans, and now we're starting to see the blowback here. So anyway, interesting. I'm not an expert on sports media or anything like that, but definitely an interesting story and something to keep an eye on. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the downfall of the Phillies farm system and take a look back at 2017, back at a time when the Phillies had one of the very best farm systems in baseball, and try and figure out what the heck happened, and maybe talk about some potential breakout Phillies in 2022. We'll do that coming up next here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season. So this time of year, generally speaking, is when you get all of the top prospect lists, and we've talked about them a lot on Hittin' Season. I know you guys talked about a couple of them on Continued Success. Keith Law's from The Athletic came out, Baseball Prospectus, Baseball America. They've all been coming out, these top 10 lists for each team, the top 100 lists, and all that kind of stuff. And it got us thinking, there was a time, not long ago, 2017, in fact, when the Phillies had one of the very best farm systems in baseball. Baseball America ranked the 2017 system sixth overall in baseball. And we wanted to take a look at that list and talk a little bit about it, because it's enough to make you cry just a little bit. And just kind of figure out, you know, what happened with these guys. It's kind of an interesting thing to look back on. And some of these names are gonna give you the feels a little bit here. So, running down the list of Baseball America's top 10 Phillies prospects of 2017, J.P. Crawford was at number one. Mickey Moniak was number two. Jorge Alfaro was number three, followed by Nick Williams at four, Sixto Sanchez at five, Rhys Hoskins at six, Franklin Quilome at seven, Roman Quinn at eight, Scott Kingery at nine, and Dylan Cousins at number 10. That is a trip down memory lane, Justin. My goodness. And I think it's interesting seeing Moniak at number two, first of all, given where he is right now and the fact that he was ever rated so highly. You know, J.P. Crawford was number one in this system for a number of years. Jorge Alfaro was traded away, and he's not produced and not become really much of a major league catcher. Nick Williams didn't develop. Sixto Sanchez is, by the way, Sixto Sanchez still a prospect, still technically a prospect. He still ranks in the top 100 prospects.
Wasn't he pitching for the Marlins in the postseason?
In the postseason, in the pandemic season, but he didn't get enough major league innings that year.
Wow.
To graduate. So, out of this list, Rhys Hoskins, number six on the list, has by far had the best major league career.
You could argue that Alfaro and Sanchez have the most value in that they were traded for JT Realmuto.
Yeah. And there's just some sad. I mean, JP Crawford, he's a great glove with the Mariners, obviously, but the bat just has never come around. But he's a solid major leaguer defensively, anyway. He's a whiz at shortstop.
He is, and you get the sense watching him play, and just like getting a sense of his presence in Seattle and what his, like, how big of a role he played and how present he was, just like in the media during their postseason push that ultimately failed. But he just seems a lot more comfortable in Seattle. Like, he just seems closer. I don't know. He's not going to be necessarily even an all-star, but he's going to be, I think, just a more comfortable player out there.
So which prospect are you most surprised didn't work out?
I'm going to say surprised. I think there's a difference between surprised and disappointed. And my answer for surprised thus far is going to be very brief, and it's Sixto Sanchez. I feel like there's still plenty of time. There's plenty of time. I still think that one can come back and haunt us just as we feared it would. But you know, at the same time, we have JT Realmuto to, you know, make us feel better for that trade. Disappointed. I have a longer answer.
Okay.
My most disappointing, I think, prospect from this group, I think it's Nick Williams, at least today. It's Nick Williams. Not because he was, I mean, you say he was fourth on the list, but, and not because he was ever particularly rated pretty high. I mean, he had some like off the field stuff that, that created issues, but just looking at like his arc, I feel like it's disappointing because, again, I never really was like, oh, this guy's got like team leader written all over him. This guy's got MVP written all over him. It was more like, this is great. The Phillies are one of those organizations that's like flush with talent. They've got the guys who potentially could be the future core. They've got the guys who could potentially be the very strong, like supporting players. And that was Williams to me. It was that he was one of those guys who could show up, you know, with the bat. He had that like power. He was always like very good at driving the ball and just an exciting young player. And when he was with the Rangers before the Cole Hamels trade in 2015, MLB.com called him one of the most promising prospects from a promising bunch of prospects, and he had already improved at the plate. His main issue was, as with all prospects, was that the raw talent was there. He just needed some more discipline. He just needed some more time, and then he landed in the Phillies organization. And you know, again, his raw tools were there. His 2016 was like not great, but he found something in 2017 and put together a really solid season. And then he finished that season with the Phillies, hitting that walk-off, but inside the park home run against the Mets on the last day of the season. And that, you know, it's the last day of the season. You're in your feelings a bit anyway. And just to see a bunch of young guys in Phillies uniforms having fun playing baseball, beating the crap out of the Mets, and doing things like hitting inside the park home runs, it was very easy to fall into this idea that like this is the beginning of something. Like the trades have occurred, the farm has been restocked, and the future is on its way. And Williams kind of authored that moment that made you feel that way. And then, you know, the rest of this kind of he just kind of spins downward in that he puts together this great May through August in 2018. Then he gets, you know, starts dealing with finger and shoulder issues. He also, I feel like Gabe Kapler never really liked him. He never really saw a particular usefulness in Nick Williams. I feel like there was a moment where Kapler answered a question at some point where he was like, oh yeah, there's guys who complain about not having enough playing time, but really haven't done something to earn it. And everyone was like, he's talking about Nick Williams. And you know, then they go out and they get McCutchen, they get Harper. And suddenly there's just this extra man on the roster who was at one point this very promising hitter who now doesn't really have a place to go. And so like after that, he's just sort of relegated to this pinch hitting reserve role. He doesn't get the playing time he needs to get back on track. And then, you know, they bring in Jay Bruce, Corey Dickerson, and suddenly he's just buried on the roster. That's not to say that he was just some playing time away from figuring it all out. But here is this promising young hitter, this promising young outfielder, who just kind of faded away. You know, he had some bounce back years. Baseball Prospectus credited him with finding his eureka moment in 2018, I believe, but then that same season fell apart again. So like there was some inconsistency there, and he was getting significant playing time at one point, but the Phillies didn't really do him any favors. And I feel like he's a big casualty, not just of the dysfunction we now know existed in the Phillies player development, but also just like Gabe Kapler. Like if the manager doesn't see any usefulness to you, you're not going to get a lot of playing time. And again, you know, that's not to say that, oh man, this guy could have really been something. Cause you know, like you said, look at him now. He's in the White Sox organization playing at AAA. He's still not a regular major leaguer, but it was just fun.
And he didn't play much last year
either. Right. That's right.
They DFA'd him.
Right.
He only played 39 games in AAA. I was just trying to do a Google search and a Google news search on Nick Williams. He doesn't even have any hits from anything after April of last year. I don't know why he only has 39 games in AAA last year. I don't know if he got hurt, if he went into some you know, if he's in the metaverse someplace and got transported into a different alternate universe or something and came back, I don't know what went on.
Where I think most of these guys are at this point. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I'm rambling, but like at the end of the day, I looked at Nick Williams at that point and saw a really promising young hitter, you know, lefty outfielder who had some power in his bat. And yeah, at the end of the day, he couldn't figure it out, and the Phillies certainly didn't do him any favors. So that was a baseball tragedy. I felt like that occurred along with all the other names we already listed.
Yeah, I felt that way about Aaron Altair. Was that guy for me? I really believed in him, but he was never a top 10 prospect or anything like that. The Nick Williams. Do you remember? I don't remember. Maybe it was at the beginning of the 2017 season when all of us from the Good Fight got together and went to the Phillies were playing their minor league stars. It was like a preseason game. Yeah, you know, but it was in Philadelphia. It was at Citizens Bank Park.
And I remember. Yeah,
and I remember just we were so excited watching Roman Quinn in center and watching Nick Williams hit and, you know, watching all the prospects play and just how giddy we were and thinking to ourselves, man, these are the guys who are going to be up later this year and next year. And we're going to start running away with the National League East. You know, there's Crawford at short and there's Kingery at second, Quinn in center, you know, and even Dylan Cousins, you just felt like, oh man, if that dude ever figures it out.
That was disappointing. Cause man, that Bash Brothers thing, him and Hoskins had in the minors was like, yeah, Hoskins is a way better chance of carrying over, but boy, it'd be so cool. And you're sitting there watching that game, watching all these guys play their positions, and you're just like, okay, even if I'm realistic about it, and like, yeah, prospects don't all come through, and like no team gets the next nine players from their farm system to play all nine positions they need, but what are the odds all of these guys and that's right, hey, not all of them did, because again, Hoskins is here, but what are the odds that most of these guys don't even, and you know, here we are. And again, you know, Williams, he had bad instincts. He committed a lot of mental mistakes out there. You know, his reads were not great, but it was, at a game like that where you were like, it was also just the timing. It was like, okay, we've been through the desert. You know, we went through 2015 and 2016. We did the thing where we hung on to the old team too long. We did the thing where we bottomed out. Now we have the prospects. We're going to be a bad team that gradually gets better and then is suddenly back in the playoff picture again. And, you know, the turnaround will occur in less than, you know, in a reasonable amount of time, I guess. And then it just didn't.
I would tell you the lesson that this taught me is that we as fans should never accept a rebuild ever again. There's never a reason to not spend money on the ball club. Even if you don't think you have the horses necessarily, you know, to compete, there's absolutely no reason to bottom out, because doing that did not do a gosh darn thing. No. Like the Phillies could have spent $180 to $200 million on their roster, or walked right up to the luxury tax in 2016, 2017, 2018, whatever it was, and they could have been a 500 team, and maybe if things break right, you know, you make a wild card, you make a play. They could have given themselves a chance and chose not to do it. And at the time, I was on board, because that's kind of how things were done in baseball. You know, you ride that wave as long as you can, and then you bottom out, you create roster flexibility and all that kind of stuff. And I still believe that to a degree. You need to make roster flexibility is more important than payroll flexibility when you're rebuilding a team. But that being said, we were fine with the Phillies doing what they were doing, because we really believed that a number of players from this group were going to ascend, and it just didn't happen. I think the most surprising player for me that didn't work out is Scott Kingery, who is still with this team, by the way.
Oh yeah.
But he is completely forgotten. No one expects or should expect anything from him in 2022. And he just feels like a guy who has been so broken by the major league hitting instructors that he was saddled with during Gabe Kapler's tenure and after, that he's just a broken player. And you know what? Maybe despite the fact he had some really great numbers in the minors, and he did in Double A and in Triple A, he always started off slow in those levels whenever he first got there, and then figured it out. And really developed power during the last bit that he was in the minor leagues. And of course, you know, like we talked about a couple of weeks ago on Hit and Season, when they gave him that major league deal before he ever played a game, that built up the expectation of we've got a star on our hands. At Buster Olney tweet, where he basically compared him to a more talented, you know, Dustin Pedroia, just built up everybody's expectations for a guy who just, I don't know if he was ever that good. Maybe he was, and the Phillies hitting instructors broke him. But that's been the most surprising to me. And I guess it's also maybe the most disappointing. I would say to me the most disappointing simply because of where he was drafted as Mickey Moniak. The fact that you had the number one overall pick in the draft and it has been such an unmitigated disaster that and you know, the Phillies did, of course, a thing where they tried to save money on the number one overall pick in a year in which there was really no consensus to kind of overpay for your second round pick and third round pick. And those picks were so disastrous, even more disastrous than Mickey Moniak, that that whole draft has blown up in their faces. And that's been well chronicled. We don't need to go into that again right now. But I think you could actually even probably flip-flop those two guys depending on what your heart's telling you about each person, because Mickey Moniak might be the most surprising as the number one overall pick to get absolutely nothing from him and know you will never get anything from him. And Scott Kingery might be the most disappointing because of how much we had built him up in our hearts and how much we had all been convinced that he was going to be this star second baseman, the next, you know, for lack of a better, you know, phrase, the next Chase Utley in that a star second baseman, somebody at second base for years that you're not going to have to worry about, an above average offensive second baseman, and a guy who always had a good glove there. Those two guys, to me, as I look at this list, are the real, are the missed opportunities here, and the ones that are real crushers.
I feel like people had reasonable, let me rephrase. I feel like people's expectations were tempered on Moniak from the beginning. I feel like he wore that number one, or at least should have been, and then eventually where, like, he wore that number one pick thing like an anchor around his neck. And I feel like that really, you know, that really, that impacts the disappointment level from him. Yeah. And yeah, like the Phillies just wound up with, from all these drafts, a lot of guys who are like, I don't know, fourth outfielder at best kind of projections. And you're like, great. How many fourth outfielders can one franchise have?
Well, I'm looking at 2018's top list now. It was Crawford, Sixto, Kingery was three, Adonis Medina was four, Adam Haseley was five, Jojo Romero was six, Jalen Ortiz was seven at one point, Jorge Alfaro eight, Moniak had fallen down to ninth the following year, and Franklin Quilome was 10th. And then by 2019, you're looking at Sixto, Alec Bohm, Luis Garcia, Adonis Medina, Haseley, Jojo Romero, Eniel De Los Santos, Spencer Howard. I mean, it gets ugly pretty quickly after that. So
man, Haseley is just another great. I talked a lot of Haseley. That did not work out.
That did not work out. A lot of missed first rounders, and that's why they desperately need Alec Bohm to figure it out this year. And the fact that he has not been able to work with anybody at the major with Kevin Long, or been able to work with Bobby Dickerson at all this offseason, really makes you wonder how much better he can be this year, because he's not getting the instruction that this was supposed to be the offseason of Alec Bohm. And it's, you know, they've had to maintain radio silence this whole time.
So maybe they've gotten rented lake houses on opposite sides and they're just communicating.
Oh, you're here too? Blink. Oh my gosh, what a coincidence. Well, let's go boating together and then we'll work on your swing.
Just blinking flashlights in the night to communicate.
Exactly. Well, speaking of Alec Bohm, let's finish quickly with this. Breakout Philly for 2022, Justin. Every good team needs to have a breakout player. Last year, the breakout player was, I think we would both agree, Ranger Suarez. Although I guess you could also kind of say Zach Wheeler was a breakout. I mean, he was always good, but he emerged as, you know, a Cy Young candidate, maybe the best pitcher in the National League last year. So that's not really a breakout. A breakout is a guy that, you know, you're not talking a whole lot about, and he leaps to the forefront and surprises you and is an integral part. And I think that would probably both agree that was Ranger Suarez last year. So for this year, Is there anybody that you're thinking of? Anybody that you're kind of keeping an eye on that could be a breakout candidate here in 2022?
Yeah, I'm going to say Matt Vierling. I know people will point to like, oh, 2021, he did break out. But I'm going to say his sample size was so small that the real breakout will occur if he is to like put together a full season, whatever that looks like for a player in Matt Vierling's role. If he's able to put together a fuller season, even close to what he was able to do when he hit 324 in 34 games with a couple of home runs for the Phillies. I mean, that was a really encouraging month. I mean, it also is a testament to how little sustained success we've seen from guys in the Phillies. Well, I'm just gonna come up, but like that was so thrilling that just to see him finish the year as strongly as he started it with the Phillies. This is a guy who in 2019. Or in 2018, he really, you know, he had struggled in the minors. He was going low. His stance was low. He was getting under the ball. He was trying to do what guys do to get to the major leagues, which was crush every pitch for a home run. That is how you hit the baseball in this modern version of the game. And guess what? Not every hitter should be taking that approach. And like Zach Eflin did with changing his approach from what he was being dictated to do, Matt Vierling was like, you know what, I got to make some adjustments here. I'm going to take a more upright approach with my stance. I'm going to stop trying to turn every hit into a home run. I'm going to start trying to drive the ball up the middle. And he saw a lot of success because of that. He made it up to Double-A. The Phillies called him up. And I mean, just imagine what the Phillies could do with a player who can play outfield position. I mean, they even stuck him in center. He can play in the outfield. He can play the corner infield. And if you can get like 2 wins above replacement from a guy who's got that role, like not even an everyday starter, but just a guy who's able to come in and, you know, hey, maybe someday if he's good enough, he works his way into a starting role. The good fight, I think Ethan Witte compared him favorably, not, you know, directly, but compared him favorably projection wise and what he was already able to do to Jason Wirth. And I mean, those are the kind of guys that the Phillies have not had over the years is the Jason Wirths who come from nowhere, find their success with the Phillies before they get their big deals to go somewhere else. And to be able to have a few years of a guy like that's who the Phillies have been missing. The guys who build around a core that is clearly capable. So I was very encouraged by what he was able to put together in 2021. I think having Kevin Long here, you know, we keep mentioning him in terms of bringing Kyle Schwarber in and working with Alec Bohm, but he's here to be a coach for everyone. And granted, I'm trying to wean myself off of talking about coaches this time of year and how much impact they're going to have on guys. But, you know, that being said, I'm doing it right now. So I think him being here would also be an asset for a guy like Matt Vierling. Again, he cannot communicate with the players anyway, like in the same way he can't communicate with Bohm. But I guess I saw enough of a promising start from Matt Vierling that he could play the kind of role the Phillies have been missing from their roster in the next year. And I feel like, you know, he set himself up to have a really great breakout year in 2022.
I like that pick. I'm my only concern about Vierling is he hits too many balls on the ground. If Kevin Long can help him elevate the baseball, he already hits the ball really, really hard.
Yeah, he hits it hard.
He could be a really good offensive player. Until he's able to do that, he's kind of a Michael Franco. You know, he has I mentioned Altair just a minute ago. He feels to me like an Altair type guy who I really feel like Altair could have been a good major league hitter if he hadn't gotten. I think he got messed up. You talk about a guy that reminded me of Jason Wirth. Even with the swing, it was Aaron Altair. He had such a similar swing to Jason Wirth. And I feel like Vierling is kind of in that same mold. He's a fourth outfielder, but I think there's some more there. I think he could be a starting outfielder in the big leagues, but even if he is just a fourth outfielder, he's a guy who can give you 15 to 20 home runs during the course of a season and be a really valuable player. So I like that pick. I think Bryson Stott's an obvious answer, so I don't think I'm going to go with Bryson Stott. I'm going to look on the pitching side, and the guy I think could have a real big impact on this team, and it could be as a starter, it could also be out of the bullpen, is Bailey Falter. I think this is a kid who, when he came up last year, had a real good strikeout to walk ratio in the big leagues. He made 22 appearances with the Phillies, had a high ERA of 5.61, but his FIP was only 3.79. In 33 and two-thirds innings, he struck out 34 guys, so more than a strikeout per inning. He only walked six batters during his time in the big leagues, but gave up a bunch of hits. He's given up 9 hits per 9 innings. So, you know, that's a lot of hits. 34 hits in 33 and two-thirds innings. Gave up 21 runs in that time. But in the minors in AAA last year, he only pitched 8 games, but he was a starter. Made 6 starts at AAA Lehigh Valley and had a 1.76 ERA last year for AAA Lehigh Valley before he was called up to the Phils to pitch out of the bullpen. I think he's a sneaky number 5 starter candidate for this team. I kind of liked Hans Kraus last year to come up, and I was tempted to pick him, but Hans Kraus is a little, his delivery is a little funky, and he kind of strikes me as more of a bullpen type guy, just based on he's got a deceptive delivery, but I don't know how repeatable his mechanics are and whether or not he'd be able to do that over the course of 6, 7, 8 innings every time out there. Whereas Bailey Falter is a left-hander. He's kind of funky already. He's got a lot of starting experience. He's been a starter throughout his minor league career. And I think there could be an opportunity for him. I don't know if Zach Eflin's going to get back in time. Depending on when the season starts, it's kind of in Zach Eflin's benefit for the season to be delayed a little bit and reclaim the number 5 starter spot. But I would not be at all surprised if it's not Zach Eflin. It's going to be between Hans Kraus and Bailey Falter to get that number 5 spot in the rotation. And unless the Phillies include Falter in a trade, which could happen once the lockout is over. I think he's a guy that other teams like and that other teams think could help somebody. I like him as a potential breakout guy, either as a late-inning reliever, somebody who becomes a dominant setup guy in like the 7th or 8th inning, or as a guy who can contribute in the starting rotation. And like you said, be like a 2-win pitcher, 2-3-win pitcher, and do for the Phillies kind of what Ranger Suarez did for them last year. Maybe not as productive. I don't think anybody should expect any Phillies rookie to have an ERA well under 2 like Ranger Suarez did last year, but maybe he can be a guy who has an ERA in the low to mid 3s and make 20 starts for you next year. I think that's, you need those types of guys if you're going to make the playoffs, and I think as far as young pitchers go, Bailey Falter would probably be my guy.
Yeah, that's another great pick. I mean, we're both going with guys who could very easily be included in trades this offseason because of how that's valuable true. They made themselves look in the previous season. But, you know, it's also nice to think of the Phillies as a team that's got talent that they can use. But, I mean, you know, I would also, depending on who they were trading for, I would also fully support a trade, even of the guy I was just talking up for the last 5 minutes.
That's right. Yeah, so both of these breakout candidates could be breakouts for other teams this year.
Yeah, we didn't say for the Phillies. Did we say for the Phillies?
No, we didn't say. Well, we did, but I think now everybody realizes.
Yeah, just cut that. Cut that.
That whole last segment's gone. All right, let's see. Let's finish things up here on this episode of the podcast. Any final thoughts, Justin, before we wrap up?
Yeah, so I think today or maybe tomorrow is the anniversary of when the Phillies decided to retire their first number ever, which I know we were just having conversations about Phillies and retiring numbers and their policy there, and that number was 36, and it was Robin Roberts, and you'll never guess what the stipulations were for retiring numbers. Not only was Robin Roberts not in the Hall of Fame when they decided to retire his number, he wasn't even retired. He was playing for the Yankees, and he was coming to Clearwater as part of a spring training game, and they decided to have the ceremony then. So as I was learning that today, I was like, you know what? Looking into this game in March 1962, I believe, I think that'll be the next one we talk about on the Dirty Inning. So, just a reminder of how things used to be when the Phillies would retire numbers.
Yeah, seriously, you need to lose that rule, Phillies. Especially, like we talked about, you know, if there is a delay to the season, you want to get the fans back on board, get everybody back out to Citizens Bank Park, bring Chase and Jimmy and Ryan and Cole out, and we'll retire some numbers, and everybody will have a good old time, and it'll be like we never left.
Yeah, if you see enough Phillies fans being like, oh, yeah, I don't care what happens, millionaires, billionaires, I'm not coming back, you put any kind of ceremony together people are going to forget that pretty quick.
Yeah, no, we're there. We are there for the hashtag content, no doubt about it. All right, folks, listen, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Justin for coming on the podcast once again and chatting me about some baseball. And, folks, listen, don't forget to tell your friends about the Good Fight podcast feed. I know there's not a lot of big news going on with Major League Baseball in terms of trades and free agency, but we're going to keep you up to date on what's going on with the labor situation and when you might be getting some baseball back, and we'll keep the Philly stuff going, too. There's still lots of stuff to talk about, as you've kind of figured out listening to this episode of the podcast. So we are at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is you get your podcasts, and head on over to the Hittin' Season Patreon too. Sign up on the $5 a month tier and you get lots of great bonus stuff over there as well. That's at patreon.com/hittin'season. Thanks everybody for tuning in. We will talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.